Hello, everybody. This is Dr. Diana Wiley, your host of Love, Lust, and Laughter. And Dr. Hernando Chavez, who's been on this program before, was scheduled to be with us May 2nd, and I was in Victoria visiting my new grandson along with his family, my daughter, son-in-law, and his older brother. And we got into this terrible traffic jam in Victoria, so we had to postpone Dr. Hernando Chavez. Welcome, Hernando.
Welcome, Dr. Diana. Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's so good to have you back. Let me tell the listeners a little bit about you in case they didn't catch the other shows. Dr. Chavez is a psychotherapist and clinical sexologist in Beverly Hills, California. And he is the president-elect for the Society for the Scientific Study of Sexuality, and he was the conference chair for our meeting last month in Los Angeles, the Western Regional meeting of Quad-S, and the program was on, the title was On Being Sexual, Innovations in Thought and Science. And I thought, Hernando, it might be interesting for our listeners to hear, before we get into two of the highlights of the program, which would be Vice Virtue and the Brain's Pleasure Circuits, and the adult entertainment panel, to talk a little bit about what it's been like for you to be president-elect. You'll be president official, I guess, in November. But it's a lot of work, isn't it?
You know, it's a lot of work, and it's a volunteer position, so I think anybody out there listening knows that when you volunteer for something, it has to be something that's both fulfilling and you're passionate about, and there has to be, I think, you know, some mutual beneficial gain. I love doing it. I love being a part of the world of sexuality, you know, whether it's doing radio shows and talking with colleagues like yourself, Dr. Diana, or volunteering for an organization like this, or setting up sexuality conferences, or, you know, whatever it may be, but it's all about promoting sex in a very positive manner and just getting the word out there, you know, spreading the gospel of sex.
And that's what, in part, what this program is about, Love, Lust, and Laughter, is spreading the gospel of positive sex. And I, of course, Quad-S does that very well, and I'm so glad that you're at the helm. You'll take over as president in November. And what's coming up, I know, but tell our listeners, in San Diego in November.
Oh, most definitely. So just to clarify, president-elect of the Western region. So there's regions and there's also the entire organization. So I just want to clarify that. Our actual president right now is Bede Robertson, who is one of the chairs at the University of Minnesota. And she's also, I believe, she is the WPATH, the World Professional Association of Transgender Health Director as well, too, which was the former Harry Benjamin Association. So, you know, we're excited. We have actually our national meeting coming this November in Tampa, Florida, and then the following year in 2013, it'll be right here in our backyard, or at least my backyard, which is San Diego, California, in 2013. So we're very excited about having, you know, kind of a bi-coastal sex science influence the next couple of years.
Great, great. And there was a little hint that Hawaii might be calling.
There, you know, there's discussion, and you know, for the Western region, we're always looking for, you know, venues that will attract people. Last year, we had it in Los Angeles in downtown LA at the beautiful, beautiful historic Biltmore Hotel. The year before that, we had a up in the Hilton in the Financial District and near Chinatown of San Francisco. So we have these wonderful venues. In the past, we've done also Hawaii. We've also done Las Vegas, Palm Springs. I mean, we really try to cater to both the combination of having a very academic and, you know, thought-provoking, intellectualized program, but at the same time, a place where we can let our hair down, enjoy ourselves, maybe get a tan.
Exactly, and I certainly think, personally, it's a great way to earn CEs, the ongoing continuing education credits, because it's fun. It's fun learning. It's interesting learning. And we are going to share with our listeners today, Hernando, two of the highlights, at least from my point of view, of the conference. And maybe we'll start with the adult entertainment panel, which was headed up by Nina Hartley, who has been in the business 28 years now. She's in her early 50s, and she has a great sense of humor because she opened up some of her, the panel was, her opening remarks were that she's now working with people younger than her implants.
Yes. That's funny.
Yeah, yeah. And you had a last, as president-elect and the conference chair, you had a last-minute kind of, see, you don't panic because you're a wonderfully calm man, as I perceive you, but there were a couple of people that were no-shows, or maybe even three for this panel, and yet it came off beautifully. Give us the behind-the-scenes what happened.
We did. I mean, as with anything that goes on, there's always hiccups, and it's how you manage the hiccups. I'm going to challenge you on how you perceive me as not being panicked, because I was panicked.
Oh, okay. Well, you covered it up very well.
It's like that metaphor of a duck that's sitting or floating on like a lake or a pond, where on the surface they seem very calm, but underneath you see those feet pitter-pattering at 100 miles an hour. So I think that's how a lot of us were, to want to make sure that we give, you know, the best possible presentation. So we actually had three people who weren't able to make it. Just unfortunately, they canceled last minute or didn't even actually cancel. And all three were adult film stars or associated in the adult film industry, which we really needed for that presentation. Thankfully, in the audience, we had the director of the Free Speech Coalition. Her name is Diane Duke, and she's the executive director and also extremely knowledgeable when it comes to the adult industry issues, because Free Speech Coalition is one of the advocates and the prime front lines fighters for free speech, especially for the adult industry.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a wonderful panel with Carol Queen, who is a PhD and a sex-positive feminist who is, you know, world-renowned for her writings and her books and her workshops. Nina Hartley, as you mentioned, who's a AVN Hall of Fame adult industry performer and also an excellent, excellent sex educator and clinical sexologist who just received her PhD, an honorary doctorate from the Institute for the Advanced Study of Human Sexuality. So we can now call her Dr. Nina.
I did not know she just got her PhD. That's wonderful, and she deserves it. She's a trained nurse going back to 1985, and she has done sex education, explicit sex education films, and she mentioned in her presentation on the panel that she sold over 1 million units combined.
Oh, most definitely.
But she also, see, these are a little different, her sex ed explicit than porn. She said there is very little porn that is educational, and very little, and this is by intent, it's fantasy. It's not about negotiation, which really among, you know, regular couples, there should be negotiation. But that said, in porn, women are their own agents, and they don't die. She pointed that out. But it's not, it's fantasy. It's not educational. And I know you have some thoughts on that, about the benefits as well as the downside.
Exactly, and I think you bring up an excellent point using the example of Nina Hartley, which is she's done both erotica that's used for entertainment purposes and also erotica that's used for educational purposes, and you can watch both of those different DVDs or both those different downloads, and you'll see the distinct difference between what is educational and what has more of like a teaching component versus what is out there to excite you and kind of create, you know, an eroticized pleasure for you to express yourself, and the two can go hand in hand. I think we actually need both.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is people don't get exposure to both. Most people don't have that educational training or that those components of how to teach you how to have sex. Instead, they just kind of teach you about what I perceive is purely the entertainment focused, with the editing, with the unrealistic expectations that people try to live up to, which is pornography. I mean, that's the fantasy.
Yes, and in fact, anyone who is anti-porn must be for comprehensive sex education, but they're usually not. You know, I think that there are a lot of people that insist that explicit sexuality can harm viewers, and this really does reflect a more fundamental problem, and I think that's the way our society defines sex, according to some formula of body parts, orifices, and movements, rather than as a combination of energy, feelings, and experience.
And I think that's an excellent point. You know, we haven't really been given the tools to know how to use porn, and that's where the misuse comes from.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if I ask all the listeners out there, how did you learn about sex? What was your sex education? What was your education when it comes to learning how to utilize and manage erotica? And most people will say, I never had not even one talk about it with my family, with my friends, with my teachers, with my school, community services. I mean, we really are at a loss with how we prepare people to, you know, interpret this erotica. And a lot of people do misinterpret it based on the fact that they just weren't given those simple tools of how to approach things.
And in fact, Hernando, I would like to open up this discussion to any listeners who might want to call in with their own personal story about their sex education or lack of it, and you would call in to 888-874-4888, and your personal story might help another listener out there. So, and you're anonymous, unless somebody's listening who will recognize your voice, but we'd like to hear your story if you'd like to call in and join the conversation. So we've got the porn, and it's about fantasy, and it's not very good sex education because you already touched on this a little bit, that you know that there'll be an 8-hour shoot, but the man is shown in pornography for 30 minutes having an erection with a huge penis attached. So what does this do for a lot of men? You tell, Hernando.
I'll tell you what, for a lot of men, it's very to watch erotica is both arousing and intimidating, and a lot of times we focus on the arousal and the pleasure, and we don't necessarily insightfully look at the underlying messages that we're internalizing that can be harmful, in that we may view a penis that's 10 inches as that's what women want because she's screaming in this video, so therefore I don't have that 10-inch penis, which we know is very rare for a person to have a 10-inch penis.
Very rare.
Extreme, you know, the average penis size is about 5.5 inches, so we're talking almost double the average of male in society.
Mm-hmm.
So what kind of message does that internalize? How inferior or what type of insecurities or lack of confidence can that incorporate inside of a person's, you know, self-worth, their sex esteem? So there's that piece that can be harmful. If people have some simple such as education to know that this is very rare, that most women actually do not prefer a large penis, that the average penis size that men have is actually what women prefer. They usually estimate about 5 to 6 inches as being the perfect size. But if men don't know that, they're making these assumptions that they need to have this equipment that is really both unrealistic and uncomfortable, because even Nina Hartley in our panel said, you better pay me extra if that penis is going to be large, and she made a joke about that.
That's right.
She's a professional, and even she doesn't want to do that unless she's getting paid for it, because it's uncomfortable and it's not fun for her.
Right, and it's not just intercourse, but it's also fellatio, the blow job. A lot of women feel like they're really going to choke if they've got this giant penis down their throat.
And you bring up an excellent point, too, let's say with fellatio and oral sex, because we're given these messages throughout pornography that the deep throat is the ultimate style of fellatio, a lot of both women and men feel that deep throating is the way that we have to perform it for a very satisfying blowjob. But the problem with that is that just about everybody out there, most people are not able to insert even a 6-inch penis down their throat, let alone a 10. So we have to learn from a sex education perspective about how we use our hands. And to use your hands for fellatio is an excellent way to sort of extend your mouth. I always teach hand job techniques before I teach oral sex fellatio techniques, because utilizing some of those twists and washing machines and those turns that we use with our hands can actually be really pleasurable and take off that pressure of having to deep throat, which I think the message that porn suggests is that that's what people want.
Can you be a little more specific about that? Because I think that's an excellent point, Dr. Hernando, that for a woman to use her hands first before she performs a blowjob, to use her hands first.
You know, when I teach in class, I teach a college course, human sexuality and advanced human sexuality.
Yeah.
I find it difficult to explain techniques, so I use a lot of erotic media. And there's a specific website that I use, and I don't know who the person who made it, nor do I, am I getting any, you know, money or am I affiliated with it at all. I just think it's a great website. It has 30-second clips on about 15 different techniques of hand jobs, and the website is actually called handjobadvice.com.
Oh, I like that. Handjobadvice.com.
And so I'll pick about six, half the clips, show them to people, and then I'll say you can utilize these twisting motions with one hand or with two hands, and then you can add your mouth to it, and that is a very pleasurable fellatio for people without having that strain or that discomfort of deep throating or the gag reflex. And it really teaches people a lot of unique styles of how to stimulate the penis in addition to oral.
Yes, and I think I often say if a lubricant is used, and I particularly like Astroglide, it doesn't have much taste, but it can make the hand job much fancier and more pleasurable if a lubricant is used on the penis.
Most definitely. Thankfully, we've made so many advancements with lubrication.
Yeah. Yeah,
we have the flavor, which can, you know, for some people be irritating, but for others be very sensual and sort of add like a scented aromal arousal for people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, at the same time, we have different types with the water base, the silicone base. We've also got the hybrid now with water and silicone together, and so people can now choose both not only the taste but also kind of the friction and the slickness and the gliding aspect of their lube, and we can really make a lot of good choices now as to what most pleasure. For us, we can even add, let's say, warming or cooling lubricants as well. Those are on the market also.
Good point. That's right. We've come a long way. Back in 1993, I was on the Joan Rivers show, and Astroglide was fairly new then, and this was television, and I gave her a bottle of Astroglide and a camera, and we talked a little bit about it. Some of the benefits, and the camera came right in close, and boy, what great advertising it was for this relatively new company at the time. And then she said, as she received the bottle of Astroglide, well, we can only hope. And then right after the show, pharmacists were calling all over, as far away as from Canada, where do we get this product?
Because wow.
In the early 90s, it just wasn't around that much. And now look what's happened. As you said, there are lots of lubes, and even the warming and cooling, you said, too.
Yeah, and it's important for us to test out some of these warming and cooling lubricants beforehand, because for some people, including myself, some can be a little too powerful, so it's almost uncomfortable. So we have to, you know, test these things out before the moments of sexual interactions and sexual activity, just to figure out what type of condom we enjoy, what types of lubes we most feel are beneficial for us. And also, too, with intercourse, I think that people don't realize that there are a lot of medications that people are utilizing, whether it's antihistamine, their SSRIs, or whatnot, and people are experiencing a lot more, females are experiencing a lot more difficulty with arousal and lubrication. So a simple application of one of these lubes can really help with some of those painful sex difficulties that people are experiencing. And it's, you know, if it's part of your routine, I think we can utilize lube as one of those components that sort of enhance our sexual functioning. And if it's part of our routine, we just all kind of go with the flow, and it becomes part of our sexual script.
That's very, very true. There's a product that's not really a lube, but it's related. It's called Zestra. And it's especially good for perimenopausal and menopausal, postmenopausal women, because it's something like 18 natural ingredients. It does not taste good. It does not particularly smell good, but boy, does it work. Mm-hmm. You don't want to use this product. It's Zestra, Zestra.com, and it's meant for women, and it really promotes blood flow in the genital region. So a woman is much more likely to reach orgasm with this Destra. And again, it's all natural products, including horny goat weed. Such an appropriate natural product for that.
Perfectly termed.
Yes. And it warms up. Now, I heard one woman say that she could not use the whole package because I had given her a sample, and in the next session she said it was almost too much. So, mm-hmm. again, your point about experimenting and finding what's right for you, lubes, condoms, you know, try them and make it kind of a fun project as you experiment with your lover.
I agree, and I think that that's another piece of sex education that we haven't focused on, which is learning these techniques on your own before you bring them into the bedroom with partners or multiple partners.
Mm-hmm.
For example, you know, you mentioned testing out this product beforehand so you know how much is appropriate for you, how much is
mm-hmm.
too much and might be painful or uncomfortable. Even with condoms, I encourage men to buy a bunch of different types. There are a number of different condom distributors. You can also buy pleasure packs where they have different types of condoms, even through the internet, and you can try them on. I encourage people to learn to masturbate with these condoms, learn to feel which one feels better for them, because some have different styles, whether it's ribbed, studded, whether it's these pleasure pockets where the head of the penis is. You know, so many different styles that when we find what works for us and what's most comfortable and makes us happiest, we can then bring that into the bedroom, and then, you know, we use that with our partners without having that anxiety of not knowing.
And so you present it with more confidence and perhaps playfulness. And if we have playfulness in the bedroom or wherever we're making love or having sex, it makes all the difference to be playful. Now, being playful requires trust and confidence, but it sure makes sex more fun.
It really does, I think that if we learn to make sex and safe sex also eroticize and part of our comfort levels, it won't be such a big deal. So when there's women who are uncomfortable bringing up the idea of condoms or lubrication, or men who feel that it takes too long to put on a condom and they lose their erection, once we get more of this experience and understanding and comfort levels, we can then bring up, from a sexual communication perspective, some of these important topics, or we're able to place that condom on very quickly. I think a great technique to teach women is also putting a condom on with their mouth, which is a very, very erotic way to be safe, but at the same time be empowered. And also, it's very pleasurable and fun.
Sure. Lou Padgett talks about that a lot and teaches in her workshops. What does she call it, the Italian method or something?
I don't know what she calls it, but it's such an effective way to, I think, eroticize the idea of putting on a condom. And most men are not going to say no to a partner putting on a condom with their mouth. I think that's a pretty amazing, you know.
Yes, exactly. They're not. And it's essential to use a condom if you really don't know your partner.
Most definitely.
Yeah. Let's go back to Nina Hartley, because she had a lot of things to say on this porn panel, to mm-hmm. shorten it a little bit. She suggested that people watch, say, sex ed porn, or even, I've made, although we don't call it porn, we call it sex education. You know, as you know, through the Sinclair Institute, I've made Great Sex for a Lifetime. I've narrated, let me stress that, I've narrated these. But, what?
Didn't star in, but narrated.
Didn't star, no.
Okay.
I'm way past that. but it's we learn so much visually, so it can be a wonderful thing. And I encourage my clients to do what she suggested, which is to watch it together and to stop it if there's something you want to talk about in a scene that's just occurred, and say, "Oh, that looks like fun," and then they can see, or that, you know, looks like something I would not like to try, but it generates conversation. And then even couples that watch explicit porn, not even sex education, some of them actually will use it to enhance their relationship, but they talk about it. It opens discussion, and then they play, and they learn from it. Some people think it's going to ruin a marriage, but that's one view. Other couples view it differently.
I agree. And Diana, when we look at the idea of using erotica as a pleasure tool, its purpose is for heightening arousal. So we have to also manage some of our own anxieties that are associated with the insecurity of seeing somebody else having sex or seeing a partner or a person that maybe our partner may be attracted to. And we have to manage and work through that and process that before we can really view this as an enhancement tool. I think a lot of people, part of their misunderstanding with pornography is that they start comparing themselves and they start looking at it as an inadequacy on their end, and how this the media that they're watching is something that they're supposed to aspire to or live up to, when these are professional actors. These are kind of the creme de la creme when it comes to body types, when it comes to their physical physique, when it comes to physical stamina. You know, when I go to a basketball game, if I catch a Laker game, I don't feel bad about my basketball talents because I watch Kobe Bryant excel.
Interesting.
That's what, unfortunately, we do with erotica, is that we start comparing ourselves and it heightens inadequacy, when in fact, when I'm playing basketball and watching Kobe, it's inspiring, and that's what we're missing, is how erotica can inspire individuals to become both better lovers and more confident lovers versus the insecurity that can be inspired.
Well, you say it, that's a great analogy, and you say it well. I mean, the number one thing that I think most men want is enthusiasm in their partner and a certain sense of adventure, that the woman is willing to try new things. And you see that in pornography, you know, whether it's play acted or not, but the woman is enthusiastic. Oh, yes, let's fuck.
You know. And Dr. Diana, there's also a movement that's going on with erotica and adult industry productions, which is somewhat inspired by this idea of making it more, having a reality component attached to this fantasy, which is a number of companies are now starting to put pre- and post-interviews of the actors to allow them to express themselves about what they desire, what they've communicated, negotiating the sexual behaviors beforehand. Then they shoot the scene and they do the editing, and then afterwards they talk about how it felt for them, what it was like to work with somebody new, and they have these debriefings, which I think normalize a bit of this idea that these two people are in this euphoric, you know, idealistic fantasy world that, you know, for us, we have to also learn that these are regular people as well, too, and they do have communication, they do have needs that need to be addressed and brought up, they do have specific requests and things that, you know, hard limits they choose not to engage in, and I think it's a little more of a realistic portrayal. So these pre- and post-interviews, I think, have started to catch on with a number of porn companies.
I did not know that, and I'm going to have to rent some porn with my partner and see about that, because I think that's an excellent idea. We're coming up to a break, Dr. Hernando, and I will circle back to some of this, but I thought we'd start after the break discussing another plenary, the opening plenary for last month's Quad S in Los Angeles, and that was Vice, Virtue, and the Brain's Pleasure Circuits. So that was such an interesting plenary, and I congratulate you on getting Dr. David Linden, a neuroscientist from Johns Hopkins, for this opening plenary. So we'll talk a little bit about that, but we'll no doubt come back to porn, so stay with us. And we are back. This is Dr. Diana Wiley, your host of Love, Lust, and Laughter. Dr. Hernando Chavez is my guest once again. He's a favorite of mine, and we are colleagues and friends as well. And he's a psychotherapist and clinical sexologist in Beverly Hills, California. And so he was the conference chair for our Quad S meeting last month in Los Angeles. And the opening plenary was Dr. David Linden, who is a neuroscientist at Johns Hopkins. And the title of the talk was Vice, Virtue, and the Brain's Pleasure Circuits. And apparently there are a whole bunch of pleasure circuitry in the brain, and they are 600 million years old. And I thought, since in past shows, Hernando, we've talked about BDSM and some kinky sex, Dr. Linden's, one of his points was that certain parts of our brain are activated by painful stimuli, and he said it's really important because pain and pleasure together, well, you got to pay attention Were you there, and did you hear him say that, or do you just know about it? I think you might know about it, but...
Yeah, I heard him say that, and I know a little bit about that as well, too. Yeah. What I perceived him saying was that we have this connection between the two, and when we look at our brain, both pain and pleasure circuitry is also intertwined. And for some people, we notice that there is a connection which comes from pain can actually produce pleasure, whereas with other people, they don't have that same wiring where the pain doesn't produce pleasure, but it produces more of like a negative response. And we often associate pleasure as a positive response. So what I think was important, what I took from the talk, is that we have different types of people. And I think the more we're studying neuroscience, the more we're studying the brain and behavior and its association with pleasure, we're going to find that it's normative for us to experience that combination of pain and pleasure, because it is going to be something that's part of the population. And when we look at the BDSM community, they, you know, what we perceive as painful, they perceive as pleasurable, or they have more of a combination, and it's in part because of the wiring. Now, we don't necessarily have the evidence yet for this wiring, but there's a lot of theoretical components and assumptions that we're making that will be tested, I think, in the next 20 or 30 years with the increases and advancements in technology. And what I believe we'll find is that for these individuals, the wiring for pleasure is going to go through those pain receptors, and we're going to hopefully come to a place where we accept that as part of our normative human sexuality process.
That's very interesting. I'm about a fourth of the way, third of the way into the book 50 Shades of Grey. Have you read it yet?
I have not read it yet.
Okay, it's very well written, and so the lead character is definitely has a dungeon and is a dominant, and so I'm looking forward to reading more, because it's fascinating, and it is a New York Times bestseller.
Yes, it is. It's taken this country by storm.
Yes, yes. I was on an airplane last night with my partner coming back from the San Francisco Bay Area, and I had the book, and I was reading it, and the person across the way, was reading it, and the flight attendant noticed it and said, "Oh, you're reading 50 Shades of Grey," and he said, "Oh, yeah," and I said, "Well, so am I," and she looked at me, and she said, "Boy, if I were you, I'd be hiding it." And I said, no, I'm a sex therapist. Everything is
open. She's promoting it, not hiding it.
Exactly, promoting it. So he had an interesting thing, Dr. David Linden had an interesting thing to say about stress and combining it and how it leads to addiction, that stress can start in the womb, that there are stress hormones that can affect a pleasure circuitry in the baby. And so it may be that early stress in life contributes to addiction models, whether it's addiction to alcohol, to marijuana, to foods, to alcohol. But gambling is another one. I thought that was very, very interesting. It can start in the womb in terms of stress.
You know, and I think it's important for us to note as well, too, that within the womb, fetuses are very susceptible to the hormonal interactions and the biological interactions of the mother as well, too. And also we have the genetic components that are predispositioned. So we have to also look at whether or not there is a predisposition genetically for some type of compulsive processing, the family history as well. And we also know, too, that with the influence that we have on infants, whether it's based on mood, let's say depression or stress or anxiety, those do have an impact on the children that are born, on the infants themselves. And there is a connection, there's a correlation between maybe higher levels of these mood fluctuations or this distressing moods if the mother or the parents are expressing that or experiencing that during pregnancy.
I wonder if there's also a connection with a colicky baby, if a colicky baby is more likely to be colicky if the mother is stressed or had stress in the womb. I don't think we know the answers to that, but...
I don't think we know those answers, but I think we have an idea that, any type of dysregulation that infants and babies and fetuses experience is going to have a profound effect on their lives and their upbringing. I mean, even looking at post-birth attachment when infants and children are not securely nurtured or not, you know, they're neglected. I mean, we see this difficulty that they experience when it comes to attachment and how that can lead to increased external and internal stress, and how that can also be manifested in either compulsive or dependent behaviors or even maladaptive expressions.
I really did. I was very fortunate, and I told my mother in the midst of a large party for her 90th birthday a couple of days ago, and so all the kids stood up and said something, and one of the things I thanked her for was the secure attachment, and I pointed out that my adult relationships have been so much more balanced and more loving because I was securely attached. She was such a good mother. She made eye contact. She held us. She breastfed us. She was very open about sexuality. And as was my father, they both gave us the facts of life, you know, talk as we were captive audience in a car trip going down from San Francisco to Los Angeles. And but, you know, that's such a blessing because I know, you know, we have a lot of our clients who have the anxious attachment or the avoidant attachment, and it impacts their adult relationships hugely.
It really does, and it's for me personally. I think the research supports it, but also what I've seen in my clientele is that, you know, it's not common to find people who are in, you know, major life distress when they've had these secure attached upbringings, like from a childhood attachment perspective up until their adult attachment. Mm-hmm. Oftentimes, we find most of these people that are in severe distress that they have difficulty managing this over long periods of time. They do have these maladaptive attachment styles, and a lot of it has been, I believe, formulated throughout our early childhood experiences and upbringings.
Absolutely, and Stella Resnick and I talked a little bit about this last week on this program, and she's, of course, big into attachment, mm-hmm. And we'll talk some more when I do part two with her, but another part of David Linden's talk was about how people that have been together 20 years, most say that they're not so passionate anymore. But one in 20 couples say, yes, they are as passionate. And when they looked at their brains, and that's the clue, we look at their brains through functional MRIs or whatever, the brains, yes, they looked like new lovers, not lovers who'd been together 20 years. And he said, we don't really know why. But then, of course, Stella Resnick said, well, if one in 20 are sexually active after a long time, and the others are more like companions, there've got to be some reasons. Maybe it has to do with really setting aside time for sex and being conscious about being romantic. And, you know, it takes a little work, but when you're on track and you're having sexual pleasure, it's reinforcing.
I think so. And my guess would be that those individuals, that those 1 in 20, probably were predisposed to being able to sustain these passionate relationships that are filled with both the companionate love, the passionate love, and also that intimacy love that, you know, over long periods of time, we've seen with research that the passionate feelings oftentimes fade within 6 months to a year. And we also notice that it takes about 2.5 years for people to start having these, you know, what we used to call the 7-year itch, people are now looking at it as a 2.5-year itch.
I know.
And so we really are, I think, haven't fostered, I think, the environments for us to really enhance a lot of these intimate, friendly, connective, you know, emotional connections that we have with our partners. We aren't necessarily doing it with our passionate aspects as well, too. And the companionate is oftentimes more associated with convenience. You know, the fact that we were together for a long time, it's too much of a distraction for us to divorce and go through that, you know, split or to move out from each other. So a lot of people get into these ruts that they feel like they're stuck in.
Well, that's right. And just to back up to the secure attachment, probably those people that have secure attachment are more likely to be able to sustain passion in the marriage. But people can, if they come out, I mean, Stella says this in her books. She came out of a rather difficult family of origin, mm-hmm. where there was probably both avoidant and anxious attachment. And then she married Alan, and he was securely attached, so she got secure attachment by proxy, by living with a man.
Mm-hmm.
But you can also get it, yeah, you can do that if you're in a relationship with somebody who's securely attached. But in addition, you can do therapy. You can do your own inner work so that you are more clear and more balanced and not so reactive. And a lot of times it takes some time to do that, but it's worth it.
Most definitely, and it would be sad. It would be a terrible existence if we felt like the way we were created, the way we became from children, is stagnant and it's solidified, and we can't make alterations or changes to improve or enhance our life. We all can make changes. We can all, you know, make through insight, through self-exploration, you know, through a lot of hard work, we can make a difference, I think, in our lives. And if experience and a lot of environmental factors are associated with attachment, I think experience and environmental factors can also be helpful with sort of unattaching some of these maladaptive styles.
Oh, very good point, Hernando. And then Dr. David Linden talked about sex and love, and he referred to Lucy Brown, and that what we can do is to exaggerate the good traits and play down mm-hmm. the bad in our loved one, and remember to be complimentary and positive as in those things. And that's going to help, too, to exaggerate the good traits. And it'll perk up any relationship, I think, to do that.
Most definitely. And, you know, to simplify, I mean, the complexity of what Dr. Linden or a number of other neuroscience researchers mm-hmm. would discuss, what we have to do is unwire the negative and then rewire the positive.
Mm.
And as simplistic as that sounds, it's much more difficult to implement. But that's really what we have to do. And whether it's through attachment difficulties or whether it's through, you know, sexually expressive behaviors that are harming us, you know, there's a number of different ways that we have to kind of reboot the system in order to kind of recreate these more positive pathways, and that can be done. I mean, we've seen it happen.
Mm-hmm. Hernando, you had some interesting things to say when we were off the air about sexual addiction, sexual compulsion. Dr. Linden was saying with addiction, all the liking gets transformed into wanting. And he claims that sexual addiction is not taking pleasure anymore in something, and it has nothing to do with the frequency. And he also said what you just said, it requires rewiring of the pleasure circuits.
And I agree with that. And mm-hmm. myself, as a psychotherapist and a sexologist, I was raised and nurtured in a sex-positive perspective, which didn't agree with sex addiction.
Mm-hmm.
And I still have my questions about it, and there's still a number of social implications that I have difficulty with. But there is some validity and I think some overlap when it comes to sexual compulsivity models and sexual addiction models when it comes to the struggle that people are experiencing. And I think we have to be honest with the fact that a number of people have difficulty managing sexuality in their lives and have the harmful impacts within their lives, whether it's legally or relational or familial or even intrapsychic with their own self-esteem and feelings of guilt or shame. I believe that in the future, I think in the next 15 to 20 years, I think there's going to be a fusion of both of these different perspectives to come together as a more of a approach that's going to not necessarily argue over some of the differences, but really focus more, I think, on some of the mutual gray areas that we have when it comes to, you know, helping people overcome some of these difficulties.
And do you think, because Dr. Linden hinted at it, that there might even be some kind of medication that would help, that we already have some medication. For instance, he pointed out, well, this isn't so much for sex addiction, so-called addiction, but, well, Bruton works more on the dopamine and not so much on the serotonin, mm-hmm. because we have a lot of SSRIs that work on the serotonin, which can lower sex drive. But, well, Bruton works more on the dopamine, which is the hormone of arousal. Mm-hmm. So he thought that, we talked about this a little bit off the air, but he thought that in the next 15 years we'd have new anti-addiction drugs or anti-craving drugs. And you thought maybe it's overly simplified because we've been looking at alcohol for many years now, and that's still a big problem.
Yeah, and I have some difficulty and some trouble when I hear people wanting to use pills or use some type of psychopharmacology to try to remedy it. What I perceive is more of a foundational attachment or an environmental issue that people are nurtured to. I think that actually better comprehensive sex education, teaching people how to, because we don't have the tools to do that, and I think utilizing a pill to try to teach that, I think it's almost like the medicalization of sexuality can sometimes be more problematic than helpful. And I'll give you an example. Why is it that in America this is such a profound issue that we are struggling with, but when we look at other sex-positive societies, they're not struggling with this? Are we just genetically mutated or altered? I mean, I look at the Germanys and the Swedens, the Norways, the Finlands, the Netherlands. They're not experiencing some of the similar rates of distress that we're experiencing. I mean, this is an explosion. It's like an epidemic in this country. Yet in those sex-positive societies, they're not experiencing that. I wonder if it has anything to do with their sex-positive, comprehensive sex education and the tools and skills that they grow up with in learning how to manage some of their sexual expression and sexual outlets.
I believe it does, of course. They have comprehensive sex education. They have less unwanted teenage pregnancies. And it's
lower rates of STIs. Higher rates of contraception use. They have higher rates of satisfaction themselves sexually. They have lower rates of divorce. I mean, there's so many different factors that we can look at and say, maybe we're not doing it right in this country.
And even going back to porn with erotic or pornography, erotic materials or pornography, it has to do with taste. And I think if something turns somebody off, well, I'd rather they just say so and then keep away from it instead of pronouncing the material morally inferior or dangerous. Just if a person doesn't like it, stay away from it. And I think there's more of that openness in some of the countries that you just mentioned, the Scandinavian countries, the Netherlands, and so on.
Right. Now, just to play devil's advocate and to, you know, challenge even myself and what I just said, mm-hmm. there are people that do struggle with their sexual expression, and a number of these people do exhibit kind of a compulsive quality and an obsessive, so more of like the intrusive, repetitive thoughts piece, mm-hmm. and also that compulsive piece, which is repetitive behaviors to satisfy those obsessive thoughts. I do think that people do have struggles. I just don't know if the magnitude of how we're viewing this concept of sexual compulsion or sexual addiction, you know, according to a lot of these different, you know, questionnaires or ways to rate yourself, you know, you can find them all over the internet. Most people would qualify as being an addict, or at least have addict behaviors, and I don't know if that's completely accurate.
I agree with you. Well, it's a very big topic, and there's lots of controversy about it, back and forth. I thought that the adult entertainment panel dealt with it very well, too, as did Dr. Linden. And good for you that you, as the conference chair, that you were able to get people to talk about this, because it's very much part of our work. And Nina Hartley, to go back to the porn panel, she said it's not the how, it's the what. That some addictions are a little bit similar to OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder, and she said overuse of anything is displacement. So you talked about the difficulty that people have.
Well,
maybe
I think
displacement.
And I agree with you. I mean, I think we have a number of different, mental health issues that people do struggle with. And to pathologize the sexual piece and make it its own disorder, I think I think it's a bit careless, because when we look at why people will express themselves sexually in a harmful manner, whether it's through compulsive masturbation or compulsive acting out behaviors, oftentimes there are underlying components of depression, anxiety, obsessive compulsive, maybe even impulse control disorders, and we're not looking, I think, at what the true foundations of the issue. We're looking at how they're expressing it on a surface level, and I think that's a bit careless as clinicians to not look at the more deeper processes that are associated with attachment or some of those foundational components that are driving and fueling these mental health difficulties.
You are, for a relatively young man, and in my eyes you're a relatively young man, you are very wise, and I think you must be a very good therapist. And I know that one of your mentors has been Dr. Winston Wild, who was on this program, well, unfortunately, too long ago. But anyway, he's a friend, too, and I think he is wonderful and wise, and you must feel very fortunate to have him as your supervisor, or to have had him. Are you still an intern, or you're...
Nope, licensed therapist, licensed marriage and family therapist, and Dr. Wild was my supervisor for about 4 years. I stretched out as much time as I could to stay with him, to have my weekly supervisions and all of my interactions with him. But now we share an office together. I still get a chance to see him on a regular basis and to exchange consultations with different clients. And what a powerful impact on me, as well as just with the idea of sex positivity. The alternative sexual expressions, the kink community, erotic minorities. He's really one of our experts, I think, and he does stay below the radar. So I'm still trying to encourage him to get out there and sort of share some of that expertise.
I know. He's brilliant, and we both have a lot of admiration for Winston. I'm going to write him an email and tell him to listen to the archive version of this so maybe his ears can burn a little bit. he's a remarkable man, and he does have so much to share. And my partner and I were house guests of his last summer, and just it was a meaningful time and fun too. Just to the long conversations we got into, and
that's wonderful.
Yes. So I feel very privilege to be able to have this program, Love, Lust, and Laughter, on Progressive Radio Network, and to have the kind of guests that I get to have, including you, Hernando. You've been absolutely, once again, a superior guest. PRN likes me to finish up a little bit before the hour is over, and so I wanted to quote from your website, you, because I think it's a beautiful quote. One of life's great journeys is to take the person that we are and walk the path to who we want to become. I'm going to repeat that because I stumbled. One of life's great journeys is to take the person that we are and walk the path to who we want to become. And that quote, is it still on drhernandochavez.com?
Yes, it is.
Builder? Good. Listeners, Dr. Hernando, HERNANDOCHAVES.com. But that is, so that's a beautiful quote. And isn't it satisfying when you work with somebody in psychotherapy to see a kind of transformation?
I'll tell you what, Dr. Diana, too often we focus on the destination, whether it's I need to ejaculate, or I need to last longer, or I need to have an orgasm, and we don't focus on, I think, the connection and the experience and the pleasure and just kind of that path that we walk down to explore and self-discover.
Right, and that's a great way to end this program. Thank you, Dr. Hernando. We'll have you back.
Oh,
bye-bye.
You're welcome, Dr. Diana. Thank you.
You're welcome. Bye.
Happy feet, da da da, happy feet. Oh, I love it, love it. Happy feet, da da da, happy feet. happy things.